If you work in quality control at a candy factory, you know strict safety regulations come with the job. It's why you partner with Grainger. Grainger helps you find the high-quality and compliant products your business needs to inspect, detect, and help correct issues. And the sweetest part is, everyone gets a product that's as safe to eat as it is delicious. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Welcome, everybody, to the show. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston. We're coming at you a little earlier on this Wednesday, but we're going to make up for it. We've got a double guest show planned for everyone today. We are going to be joined by the returning Richard Deitch from The Athletic and to break down tariffs, Brandon Ross from Lightshed Ventures. He will be also returning to the show after a much celebrated appearance last time that we had him on with the AEW faithful. Brandon, how are you? Have you considered branching off into straight economics for all of us?
I'm desperate to branch off into anything at this point.
It has been quite the week, and I know what everyone is thinking out there. How does this affect me as a consumer of pro wrestling? We're going to try and get down to that a little bit as the markets are plummeting.
And who doesn't love a good spreadsheet?
Yes. Who doesn't love a very simplistic formula that is camouflaged with symbols to basically get to what I don't think any economist has given a thumbs up to this whole process as the markets are in shambles, but making for some tremendous headlines, I will say.
Yes, TKO stock is affected as well as the entire stock market. But it's been, what are we at right now? $137 is where the TKO stock is if you look at that year to date. Well, TKO has done better than a lot of stocks lately, but you know they're at just under the level that they were at the beginning of the year.
Yes, I mean it is a positive that WWE they don't manufacture pro wrestlers in China, so that's one thing they have going for them, dealing with human beings that we sell to our public.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some real things to consider, especially when it comes to consumer products and things like merchandise, T-shirts. This could be a real crisis for replica belts, which I understand are imported. If you look at the replica belts that are listed on WWE's online shop, they do say they are imported. They're probably coming from China or from another Asian country. That's probably the same for AEW replica belts as well. But also, I would think, you know, any kind of other products that are using a wrestling license, like action figures and various other things.
Well, maybe right next to the factory where all these American jobs will be created to screw in iPhones, we can get a separate factory to create all of these jobs for replica belt manufacturing.
Yes, I think there are a lot of Americans who are eager to work in factories and bring back the manufacturing industry and work for $4 an hour and things of that nature.
We'll talk about a bit more of that with Brandon Ross, but we have the Ring Boy lawsuit to talk about because over the last couple of days, all of the defendants have filed motions. And guess what their response has been to this Ring Boy lawsuit? Did they all agree that there were some very significant claims made in this, and we need to get to the bottom of this to see if these John Does have been wronged? What was the response from Vince, Linda, and WWE? And did they all have identical language to respond with?
They had some similar language. I want to focus on some of the language that was used by WWE and Vince, but later. So they're all arguing. They're all in unison here, saying that this is in Maryland. This is in federal court in Maryland, and it's in federal court in Maryland because Maryland has established the 2023 Child Victims Act, which has removed all of the statute of limitations, removed any time limit that you could have had on filing a lawsuit against somebody who you say was abusing you as a child, or for negligence that led to that abuse. Maryland, there's only a few other states. I did look. There are other states that have done this. I think New Hampshire and Vermont may have similar laws, but it's an extreme minority of U.S. states that have laws like this that will allow something like this, a lawsuit related to alleged abuse in the 1980s, that would not just preclude that by a time limit. So they're all saying, Maryland, I don't have any connection to Maryland. I didn't do anything related to these allegations in Maryland. So we should not be under the jurisdiction of Maryland court. That's what Linda is arguing. That's what Vince is arguing. All separate lawyers here. And that's what WWE is arguing. WWE even is saying that, hey, in this complaint filed by the plaintiffs back in October, you haven't even laid out an argument about why this has anything to do with us. We're World Wrestling Entertainment. That was the World Wrestling Federation. You've got to make an argument about why we inherit the liability of the companies that came before us.
And to that, your argument would be, or your response would be, when they bought this company, they were able to just take all of the benefits of this multiple decade long company, but the liabilities do not come with it, correct?
I think the liabilities probably come with it. I mean, so TKO was a merger, of course, and they merged that company. They didn't just buy some of the assets. They merged the company. But, this is a legal argument. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, it's also noted, and Brandon does have stories up on the Post Wrestling site if you want to go through this, because Linda's motion came down Monday, and then what followed were responses from Vince McMahon and WWE separately. But Vince McMahon's attorneys stated that five unnamed adults, none of whom are from Maryland, have come to this jurisdiction pleading decades-old allegations from the 80s in an attempt to capitalize on the recent Maryland Child Victims Act of 2023. The complaint attempts to manufacture such knowledge by spouting a broad catalog of negative press, unfounded opinions, speculation, and multi-level hearsay from a hodgepodge of characters, many of whom are deceased. A hodgepodge of characters. So I would just state that in an attempt to capitalize on the recent Maryland Child Victims Act, well, like, in some way, yeah, because this is one of the only states that allows for you to bring about these issues that don't have to be under a statute of limitations. So yeah, there is a strategic nature to filing this in Maryland because you are not allowed to do this in other states that the WWF at the time was running as well. So, I mean, this is ultimately going to come down to, you know, this decision if the jurisdiction is considered disqualifying to this case. And also worth noting is that Linda McMahon claimed flat out she now knows the identities of these five John Does, which we will see if they are revealed publicly.
That's unlikely. There was an order last week, and it agreed that the judge allowed that the defendants would be able to know the identities of these five anonymized John Does. They're allowed to know their actual name, their current residential address, and their birth date. The public is not allowed to know the identities of those people. The defendants are not allowed to disclose the identities of those people. And I understand this is something that's fairly common in cases where you do have people under pseudonyms who, for understandable reasons, want to keep their identity secret. But they want to get justice for what they claim is in this case, child sex abuse. But the defendants often do get to know who is actually suing them.
Yeah. So I think if you're looking at this, again, this is not the case of Vince or Linda McMahon being accused of wrongdoing in the sense of anything that they inflicted upon any of these John Does. This is an argument of them, the two of them, overseeing this company and the plaintiffs needing to be able to prove that there was knowledge of what was going on and that it was ignored. And in the case of Vince McMahon, I mean, we do have the straight from Vince McMahon's mouth to Dave Meltzer and Phil Mushnick about Mel Phillips' dismissal in 1988 and subsequent return to the company with the warning of that he must steer clear of kids. That in many instances would be a pretty significant smoking gun. With Linda McMahon, it might be more difficult to be able to prove that she had knowledge of this, of what was going on, and turned a blind eye. But that is going to be the crux of this case for the John Does as this case proceeds, or if ultimately this is a case that is settled and quietly goes away without these John Does being identified.
Yeah. And if we haven't mentioned already, it's Mel Phillips, the former ring announcer who has passed away in 2012. He is the one who is alleged to have abused various ring boys throughout the 1980s. I think one possible strategy here is that they're trying to avoid discovery. If you just try to get this case dismissed based on jurisdiction, they're not pushing back against the allegations. They're not saying that it's true, of course, but they're not trying to deny and undermine the allegations themselves, I suppose, because that would lend itself to discovery to try to find out whether that's a motion that the judge would approve of. But if it's just a jurisdictional issue, well, maybe you could get this thrown out and pushed off into another court where it would be far less viable just by saying, look, these people, you know, Vince lives in Connecticut. Linda has residences in Connecticut and in Washington, D.C. She doesn't live in Maryland, although she did rent an apartment there and from 1970 to 1972. And WWE saying, you know, we're not headquartered in Maryland. We're not incorporated in Maryland. They're incorporated in Delaware. Of course, their headquarters are in Connecticut. While they do run events, and they are alleged, you know, they did run events throughout the 1980s, of course, and the Ring Boys alleged that they were abused in related to events and were abused in Maryland as well as other states.
Yeah. And to Linda's motion as well, like she is arguing that she didn't know any of these John Doe. She was not overseeing.
We got a lengthy
them.
Statement, lengthy declaration from Linda McMahon.
Yes. And, you know, in the case, like we can look at, you know, the most prominent known of the Ring Boys was Tom Cole, and Linda McMahon was very much attached to Tom Cole, and but Tom Cole is not one of the John Does here, of course. He passed away a number of years ago. But in that case, that is Linda's argument here, is that she was not on the road. She was not at these shows. She was not overseeing the ring crew. She was not overseeing Mel Phillips, and she had no connection to these five John Does. So she is arguing essentially that she is just being lumped into this when it's really not her. It was not her purview in the company. That's her argument.
And part of what the defendants are raising here as well is they say in the cases of John Does 1, 2, and 3, they don't even make a specific allegation of abuse. Although I do think in a general sense, they are saying, yes, I was abused in Maryland. They don't provide a specific instance that is described in their complaint about being abused in Maryland. The defendants take issue with that as well. So that there's that they're saying too.
Yeah. And more so just on just a kind of coverage standpoint, it was noteworthy, I think, just the fact that this file, this motion that came out, even with Linda's prominent position within this cabinet, I mean, to me, it's just this Ring Boy lawsuit is a complete like non-entity in especially a week like this, where, I mean, this is just file this under scandals involving government officials. That is just does not cross the threshold that it really is going to gain any kind of attention outside of wrestling sites.
And did you know that Linda's first pick for her cabinet position was not Secretary of Education, Secretary of Commerce, and that is Howard Lutnick's position in the cabinet now.
Wow. Well, she could have had more headlines this week had she.
Yes, she could have been. She could have been at the center of all this.
Yeah, she could have been. Someone could have enacted her on Saturday Night Live potentially.
Yes.
But everybody, it is time to get into our first of two guests. We're going to solve the whole economic crisis over the next 15 minutes. So just take some notes and everything is going to be make sense for everyone here, because we have Brandon Ross from Lightshed here to shed some light on what's going on in the professional wrestling economy as well.
But I think that's a little easier than the global economy. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, tell me, like, from your specific vantage point, Brandon, what the last number of days and the concerns you're hearing of a lot of the companies that you oversee. And
yeah.
I mean, is there sort of just a hands up in the air approach that God knows what day to day is going to look like? Or is it just panic, fear, all of the above?
I don't think the media industry is any different than any other industry right now. There's a reliance, a strong reliance on advertising, mm-hmm. and advertising comes back to how well the consumer is ultimately doing. And that's a big open question right now. And I don't think I have any insights on that that are above and beyond what you guys or anyone else has at this point. No one knows how this trade war is going to pan out. And I think that all the companies I follow, at least, are pretty much in a wait and see mode, and like everyone else. So it's been a strange time for me to do my job, because my job is to pick individual stocks, as you know, and to opine on our industry. But the macro is kind of dictating everything right now.
Yeah, I was thinking it through yesterday. What areas of business could be especially affected? And I think consumer products seem obvious. WWE is a big seller of merchandise, of apparel, of licensed consumer products. I would think the media rights fees, the media deals are probably safe, at least the ones that are existing. But you have thoughts about, like, in UFC here too, they've got a deal that's in negotiation right now, and WWE wants to renew the rights that are currently held by Peacock for their PLEs and their library. Like, what effect could a trade war have on those deals?
Yeah. So I think the way you started it is kind of the good and the bad, right? The good is they probably have 20 years locked in with Netflix for the Raw and SmackDown deal. So that puts a floor under what earnings are going to look like going forward, for sure. But after that, what's really going to be the biggest determinant on the future of this company is especially how this UFC deal goes. And we all know that, I think it's next week, the exclusive period with Disney, is over. My guess, and this is with no specific knowledge on the situation, but just knowing how all the counterparties are in a real wait and see mode, that it's just going to make sense to kind of let the economy play out, let this trade war play out for at least a couple of weeks or a couple of months before you get back to real negotiations. And I think that works on both sides. I don't think that if you're a media company, particularly a traditional media company, if you have no idea what the ad market's going to look like going forward, you have no idea what you can afford for any rights. And similarly, I don't think TKO wants to get into a situation where they're selling into a very, potentially tepid market and want to make a mistake. So I think it behooves everyone just to put this discussion off for a couple of months. And that's what I expect on gut feeling is going to happen, just speaking with a lot of different media companies.
No UFC renewal coming up in the coming weeks then.
I would be extremely – never say never, but I'd be extremely surprised right now. And I think it's also kind of a strange time in the general sports and entertainment rights landscape anyway, because you're in a situation where the NBA and NFL took a lot of oxygen out of the room. There's a bunch of rights that are in the marketplace now, and there's scrambling going on with different objectives for the different various rights holders. You've seen with TKO, they've talked about it. UFC wants to not just get a lot of money, but they also want to get a lot of exposure. So that's going to involve a deal with probably multiple counterparties, where you do a deal with potentially a Disney, despite some of the conflict that we've heard back and forth over the last couple of months, and do a deal with a Netflix or an Amazon who has much broader reach to bring, and trying to balance those dollars and that reach is a bit of a project. And I think you need a marketplace that has a little more certainty around it economically, given the complexity there anyway.
Go ahead, John.
I was just going to say, like, obviously, we're going to be using if quite a lot in all of these discussions, but the idea of like a significant decrease in ad spending, like just going back 5 years to the pandemic, a lot of these streamers came out of it. Like there was a lot of, prosperity that a lot of these streamers experienced, where you contrast this to broadcast and cable, you would think like there's going to be a lot more short-term effect and potential long-term effect. If we're looking at this, that streamers can somewhat stomach this a bit more, even as they are trying to build out these ad tiers.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at the composition of revenue for Netflix, it's obvious, despite the efforts that you just highlighted, it's very, very much weighted towards subscription. And if we do go into more challenging economic times, that Netflix deal that you get to be a member is going to be an awesome one for entertainment that brings a lot of value. So I think you're going to continue to see them thrive. But then look over at Amazon. Amazon is a, quote, streamer. But it's also a part of a very complicated company that is going to really feel the effects of this trade war potentially. You saw in the news last night that Amazon isn't accepting shipments from China now. A significant number of the products that are sold on Amazon come from abroad. If you're talking about infrastructure build out for AWS, a lot of those components come from abroad. If there's a slowdown in investment from some of their counterparties, that could potentially affect them. So there's so much question right now in the marketplace. It just, again, behooves everyone take a pause. There's still time left on this deal, and figure it out in a month or two. When there's a little more insight into just what's
for people who might not be familiar with how these media businesses work, like what is the risk to an NBCU or a Netflix or a Disney that's going to make them want to hold on to their money?
Disney has a lot of capital investment that they're doing right now on theme parks and cruise ships, and they're very levered to how their parks business does, which is much more economically sensitive, shall I say, in addition to being, largely ad supported in a number of different aspects of the business, and theatrical and how that plays out. There's a lot of different ways that a Disney or Warner Brothers can get hurt in this environment, even if the streaming aspect of their business does okay.
And I would say you probably even see people maybe be more willing to cut the cord if they're having economic hardships, and if the prices at the grocery store are skyrocketing, that maybe, cutting cable and only holding on to a few streaming services or something like that is a choice that people make.
Totally. And don't forget, one of the reasons during the pandemic that all of these streaming services did as well as they did, and of course you're going to want, it's a good value to have a couple of them in this environment, but everyone did okay because no one had anywhere to go and everyone was still making money because whether it was actually making money or because the government was subsidizing at that time. So I think this is going to be a different type of situation than we saw during the pandemic. If this, and by the way, this could all get resolved tomorrow. I don't know what's in the president's head. Trust me.
Howard Lutnick said these are permanent. They're staying.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see how long Howard Lutnick lasts.
Regardless. Do you look at the inventory for UFC that is pretty much a weekly touring event that they have now with their premium pay-per-view events as well, sort of getting into the mindset of ESPN that pays them this flat fee for their pay-per-views every single month, regardless of what the card is, and trying to get into like what are ESPN's wants going to be for the extension of this, and knowing that there's going to be other bidders at the table as well. Like,
I think ESPN's goal right now is they took on some cost increases for the NBA, and there's escalators in the other rights, and they want to make sure that they are able to grow their bottom line, because that's what they've promised to the street, which means that they're going to be a little bit more selective in the other sports and properties that they commit to. My guess is they're going to want to keep an amalgamation of lots of different sports, because they want to be the home for sports, but they don't have to do it 100%, which means taking a piece of the puzzle, not the entire puzzle this time around. So that's my guess. I think the pay-per-view remains the most attractive. We talked about risk. If the consumer does weaken in the near term, there may be less pay-per-view buys and more piracy. But generally, you could put a predictable dollar figure on what those pay-per-views are going to be worth within some range. So my guess is they try and do part of that deal. The rest of it goes to a Netflix, where you could have 4 events per year, and they can be offered to members outright, and that gets a lot more eyeballs and attention there. The big question is that weekly, because that weekly doesn't get a lot of eyeballs right now. especially behind ESPN Plus. The goal for TKO is to get that in front of more people, but the pricing on that is very difficult to determine. Will there be a lot more viewership if it's outside of ESPN Plus? Are the cards, especially there, good enough to attract a lot of attention? That's a very difficult property to put a dollar figure on.
I guess thinking through these negotiations, if this condition of the market continues, is Netflix not in sort of the best position to continue?
They definitely are. I mean, they could kind of sit back now, and if the value of rights falls and they see opportunities, they are in the best position to pick things off.
And why is that? Rates. Why are they in the best position?
They're in the best because, like I said before, they're still mostly a subscription business that offers a ton of value. I think they're the default streaming service. And if we get into a poor economic situation, and by the way, they have no financial, like real financial, they have financial leverage, but they don't have to be concerned with their financial leverage like others do. They're in the position to say, okay, this is what I think this is worth. If the rights come down to my price, I'm just going to pick them up because I have stability. And that's a big advantage that they have. And you see, look at stock prices, it's reflected in the stock price, that relative stability.
3 months into WWE's programming moving to Netflix, at least Raw domestically, internationally as well, in so many different markets, how would you assess what this move has meant for the WWE product, and with a week out till WrestleMania, the most watched WrestleMania of all time, given the scope of Netflix?
Yeah. I mean, I think it has, first of all, the product, in my view, has been amazing. I'm excited for WrestleMania. So,
are you going?
I'm only, unfortunately, because Sunday is when I really want to be there. I'm only going to be there for Saturday. But I will be there. I don't think Netflix has anything to do with the job that Paul is doing from
Ted Sarandos is not standpoint. Picking up the book now.
Yeah, I don't think Ted is is doing in the writer's room at all there. But it's the exposure, right? We talked about the importance of it for UFC. I think it's even more important for UFC given it's in a still relatively nascent and has less audience than WWE does, both domestically and on a global basis. But I think that exposure is really what you're unlocking on Netflix, which you're going to see flow through. You mentioned consumer products before. God willing, the economy's okay. That should work its way through there. And you've seen what they've been able to do from a live events perspective, and just more demand for live events, and ultimately pricing that's reflective of that.
Yeah, their attendance has held up well. It's continued to grow even despite the ticket prices going way up. I don't know if you're watching the global viewership numbers that Netflix puts out this closely. So India just rolled out WWE on Netflix as of April 1st, and we got this 7-day number for the most recent data point that we have for Raw, which is the 31st. So like by 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, it's like early morning hours. So they had the full 7 days in India to watch Raw, but there's no noticeable impact here. It was about the same. It was slightly lower than it was the last week.
Yeah.
I was surprised by.
Understandable, but one thing people forget is the subscriber base in India isn't that big, right? Everyone thinks 12 million.
Oh. Yeah, it's very low.
Yeah, I mean, that's fractional. That's a sixth of what it is in the United States. Right. So I don't think that's going to immediately really – that market's going to immediately move the needle. But as you see here, the viewership's been pretty consistent for the last several weeks. You obviously got that initial bump on the premiere, and it's – you know, we're pretty much in the same range since.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
When we're like forecasting right now, like if Netflix believes like that this has been a tremendous investment for us, these streaming rights are on the table next year as well. How significant of a pillar right now is WWE's PLE programming to Peacock specifically as they're looking at potentially a very aggressive suitor in Netflix?
Yeah, I've spoken to a bunch of different people in that organization over time, and the reaction has been mixed. I mean, I think it was immediately much more important when the total subscriber base was much smaller. Now that the subscriber base is much larger from a percentage basis, this content isn't going to move the needle to the same extent. That's just math, right? At this point, they did spend a lot on the NBA, and I think that they'll probably be reasonably price sensitive. But I do expect Netflix to go after this pretty hard and try and complete the global rights. And so you're going to be in a competitive situation, which is very different than what we saw, last time around when the Raw and SmackDown rights were up.
Yeah. And I would think those are the two main suitors for those rights, for the PLE library rights, would be Peacock keeping it and Netflix wanting to add to, they won't have everything at that point because SmackDown would still be on NBC, on USA, and NXT is on CW, but it would more complete the domestic rights that they have.
Oh yeah. It would give them all the top tier rights on a global basis.
I know on your most recent show, you were discussing this topic, and it's one that is routinely coming up amongst a lot of wrestling fans, that as much as they're watching with the product, like there's a growing segment that is just priced out of a lot of these events, and WWE's ticket selling, it's as Brandon noted, has been doing very, very well. But how is Kid Rock figuring into this conversation at the moment when it comes to Live Nation and the secondary market out there? What is going on here that is reaching the White House levels of discussion on ticket?
Yeah, what's going on with his outfit is question number one.
Certainly,
that was pretty wild. He had Zelensky beat on what he wore to the White House there. But look, right now, a big problem in the ticketing world is that whatever price the content owner, whether it's the artist or WWE in this case, puts tickets on sale for, if it's not efficiently priced to demand, then scalpers come in and buy up the tickets. Whether, you know, if it's for Taylor Swift or something high profile or WrestleMania, they'll take those tickets with bots at the on sale. Otherwise, they'll do their analysis and they'll buy up tickets as they're mispriced. So essentially what needs to happen is either on the primary ticketing side, the content owners need to price to market, or there needs to be the secondary market. The brokers need to be neutered in some capacity. And so there has been what's called the Bots Act, which makes it illegal to use these bots, but it's never been enforced. So one of the things that Kid Rock is asking for is enforcement of that Bots Act. The other thing that he brought up was potentially capping the sale of secondary at a 10 or 20 or 30% premium, which would again allow content to price and get tickets in the hands of fans at the price they set it at.
They really missed out on an opportunity for the Ba Wida Bot Act, potentially, if Kid Rock was leading this through. I'll see myself out the door.
Nice joke.
But it's one that, I mean, it's, you know, as much as this is, you know, this fan complaint that you get both on the UFC side and the WWE side, it's like they are packing these arenas and they are supplying with a demand that is through the roof at this point in time. And it tells me that, yeah, it's unfortunate that there is a fan base that just cannot afford to go to some of these shows, but it's across the board in live entertainment.
Yeah, I think, again, a great way to handle that situation would be, and that this is kind of anti-capitalist, but if you put a cap on those secondary sales, then you could come out and WWE can price tickets for fans, if it's not all the way up front, at least it in the back of the house at a price that's much more reasonable for the average person to be able to afford, without the worry that those will just get snapped up by the brokers and they'll resell them at whatever the market value should be. And I think that's one tool that could potentially help solve this problem. But it's difficult because there's such an emotional attachment to these events, and sometimes the supply and the clearing price on supply and demand isn't the best for the long-term health of the business.
Yeah, I don't know if capping ticket prices has ever been uttered out of the mouth of Mark Shapiro, but maybe
on the secondary market.
On the secondary market, yes, of course. They will do a very healthy number of gates next weekend. Brandon, is this suffice to say going to be the largest revenue driven weekend for WWE, excluding our
not attendance,
not attendance, but gate wise, excluding Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it seems that way. But for I mean, and Brandon's closer to those, the other Brandon's closer to those numbers than me. But it was definitely a weird weekend to do it. If you wanted to absolutely max out revenue, doing it. I mean, essentially, the weekend is Good Friday through Easter Sunday, and it's in Vegas, which, you know, much more kid friendly than it used to be, but not the ultimate, you know, kid friendly place.
Yeah, just by the sheer ticket prices that we can all see on Ticketmaster, this should blow away last year's number, which is, I believe, 38.5 million. I assume that they've already sold well beyond that for the 2 days, and I would expect that. So we know the individual record, adjusting for inflation, which at the time was 17.3 million in 2016, and it's something like 22 million in today's dollars. I would think that both of these individual events will exceed that too.
Yeah. And next year will probably be much bigger.
My last question for you, Brandon, if you had to
next year is New Orleans, right?
Yes. New Orleans, yeah. Two nights, yeah. In New Orleans.
That's what Dwayne said.
Yes. Just looking into your crystal ball in, I'll give like in this next contract of UFC, do you expect that monthly UFC pay-per-views will still be a reality? The idea of plopping down $80 per show, or could you see this eventually just reaching it where one of these distributors just want to pay a fixed amount and it is comes with a cost of subscription? Because we saw WWE go that model, and it's very hard to go back to pay-per-view afterward.
My base case is it'll still be mostly pay-per-view, and that there will be, you know, a handful of events per year that'll be sprinkled in that'll be on likely Netflix.
Well, we look.
But by the way, Amazon, I expect, and I'm going back on something that I had previously said. If Amazon is involved, I do expect it to be from a pay-per-view perspective. I think I underestimated how important building out pay-per-views in their channel store actually is to them, and that's the approach I think they want to take, especially with matching revenue to cost, which I think is pretty important to them as a more data driven company.
Yeah, Prime is doing pay-per-view and boxing pay-per-view. They just started doing AEW pay-per-view.
Yeah. It's a big initiative there. So I expect it to go. I think that if we're going to be not behind I'll call it the pay-per-view wall, and instead behind a membership wall, that'll be on Netflix.
Well, Brandon, we want to wish you luck in earnings call season coming up, and how many ways we can ask questions about what's going to happen to the economy that I think will be every single question, and how many executives can come up with optimistic answers for their analysts out there.
Yeah, or say they don't know in however many
ways. We can say we have no idea what is going
to
happen.
So sometimes we just have to be intellectually honest and say we don't know.
Well, enjoy night one of WrestleMania, Brandon. We thank you very much for stopping by, and we encourage everyone to follow along with Lightshed Ventures, where every week Rich, Walt, and Brandon break down the entire industry and try to make sense of it, from Kid Rock to all things in between. We thank you, Brandon.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Brandon.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Yeah.
All right. That was guest number one, and man, we're bringing you the 1-2 punch this week, because now that was our American representation, but now I get the numbers advantage because I'm bringing on
I'm charging both tariffs for this, by the way.
You know, we actually have like co-custody here, because also a native of upstate New York, but yeah, resides here in Toronto. We have laid claim here. Elbows up here. It is time for Richard Deitch to return.
Hi, Richard.
To Pollock and Thurston. Hello, Richard.
Like John Cena coming in with my hustle loyalty Canada respect hat there.
Yeah. I think even Brandon would acknowledge that Canada are the baby faces in this equation. Oh. I think a lot of sympathy for us just getting beaten around here on a routine basis.
Baby face level of like Hogan in 86. Yeah, I mean really not even that close.
Yeah, well, we won't take all Hulk Hogan comparisons, but
sadly, like everything in the world in wrestling, things flip very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, didn't age so well was when Terry Bollea. But Richard, welcome back to the show. It is great to catch up with you. And we were just chatting with Brandon Ross, sort of just kind of, you know, naturally we're looking at, you know, just this economic insanity at the moment, and ultimately issues that will permeate to, you know, these various broadcasters. And I'm sure, like, you're looking at this from the level of, you know, a lot of broadcast and cable right now that have to be certainly extremely nervous about an ad market that could fall through, and just continuing a very volatile industry that they could be facing with, you know, just the uncertainty that these months are going to provide.
Yeah, no, I listened to Brandon, and I think the best thing that he said at the end was that you have to have intellectual honesty in terms of not knowing what's going to happen, because, you know, with governmental policy changing, you know, by the minute, perhaps, you know, or the second sometimes, you can't plan for stuff. I mean, the reality is, in, you know, the media space, there's ad budgets that go, you know, 12 months, you know, sometimes you want to even have a broader perspective. And so just, if you think about just ad buyers, like, where do they want to put their money? And how much money do they have to spend, you know, depending on if we're in some kind of recession or stagflation or something like that. So this stuff that absolutely affects the media economy, because, one, you have to figure out how much dollars exist, two, you know, where those dollars that exist will go. And then three, and this is even a bigger issue, what kind of mood are consumers going to be in, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of just, like, accepting whatever your product is. And I think, you know, given what your product is politically, some people may be in a very good position. Others may be in a terrible position, just depending on how the American consumer feels about that product vis-a-vis what the price is. So, you know, we're in unknown territory right now. And I think, you know, I'm not any genius by saying this. If you're a media company, an ESPN, a Netflix, Amazon, et cetera, you're probably going to be very, very cautious in the near term, just in terms of, like, big spend. And so the places that have already outlaid money for media deals are at least in a decent position, because they know what that fixed cost is. But it'd be interesting to see where the UFC lands, right? Because depending on where the economy is, I think any place that's thinking about bidding on them just has to, you know, they got to think about, like, not, you know, what our money situation is today in 2025, but what's our financial situation going to be a year from now, 2 years from now. So that's a challenging time. If you're the NBA or the NFL or some place that's already locked up a long-term media rights deal, your time may happen to be on this one pretty good.
Yeah, I'm thinking through other periods in history when there have been recessions and what effect that has had on at least the wrestling business. And, like, the Great Recession of 2007, 2009, it doesn't strike me as, like, a cold period for WWE's business. I think there was a lot of international expansion around those years too. And COVID was a unique recession. And, yeah, and they did well because they had guaranteed media rights fees. But the early 2000s, I guess that's a cooling off period for the Attitude Era. I don't know that the recession had anything to do with that. But it seems like, you know, even if there's a serious economic impact, wrestling does okay. In that case, anyway.
Yeah, it's a little market immune because of the passion and intent. You guys know this better than me, the passion and intensity of the fans. You know, the one thing I would look at it would be, you know, let's say 7 months from now, like, how are ticket sales for AEW and WWE? And do they tick down a drop? It's not going to be an issue with Netflix. Not going to be an issue with WBD. You know, people will watch or they won't watch. But that's something, you know, merchandise, ticket sales, those are the things I'd pay attention to, and I'm sure WWE and AEW are paying attention to that. And the interesting thing is, for both of those businesses, they're global businesses. So, you know, we're not just talking necessarily American markets, you know, in terms of tickets and merch. It'd be, you know, how are the Europeans feeling at the moment, and where's their passion to buy? WWE, again, probably in terms of timing, could not have timed this better with their recent European tour. Right. And they're now heading back to the States. You know, I don't know what the anti-American sentiment is right now, let's say in London or Brussels or whatever, but it could be, like, a lot worse, right? 6 months from now, 8 months from now. So in terms of their timing, the fact that they did these European shows now, they're probably, their timing on this would be pretty good. But I hear what you're saying, Brandon. And I think, you know, the reality is there's always going to be things where your discretionary income is going to be spent, and you just will determine that that's an important part of your life, even if you're sort of struggling. For a lot of people, that's Netflix, right? For a lot of people, that could be alcohol. For a lot of people, that could be going to a game. And I think for wrestling fans, like they would consider, at least in my opinion, like having a Netflix subscription, like as important, I don't want to overstate it, but whatever your sort of household goods are, like they're part of that budget. I think it's all priced in. So I agree with you.
Yeah. And you brought up a great point, Richard, just about as well, like attitude towards a lot of these products. And I think you and I kind of have this, just being here in Canada at the moment, like it's impossible to ignore what the sentiment is right now. We had just that example at Elimination Chamber recently where they booed the American anthem to Pat McAfee's chagrin. And in the case of a UFC that has just wrapped itself around this administration, you know, they're coming up to Montreal in May for a pay-per-view as well. And just more broadly, like the UFC is just, it's as entwined politically as a sports brand could be, very much contrasting to WWE that has stayed very apolitical through both of these Trump terms.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, to be blunt, I think probably for Dana White and company, it's probably a good economic strategy. They've basically they've cornered the market on like MAGA fandom. There's a lot of money to be had there. They don't need, you know, left-leaning avocado toast eating once upon a time Tesla drive in San Francisco people to, like, you know what I'm saying, go to an MMA event. Like they'll be fine on that. So I think in that case, I think Dana White, like, he's all in terms of his relationship with Trump. Like, so I don't think it's kayfabe. Like, I don't think it's trying to fake out to get more fans. But I think for them, that business model works. WWE is a little bit different. Like, we're in a different era. I think they have to stay apolitical, certainly in terms of storyline and stuff like that. But, you know, you guys cover this better than anybody. They're not always apolitical. They got deals with Saudi Arabia. You know, they'll pick and choose when their politics will work. But
they're doing a Tony Hitchcliffe roast
right on
WrestleMania weekend.
Yeah, so they pick us. But to Nick Khan's credit and Triple H's credit, they're not, you know, we're not getting like an Iron Sheik Nikolai Volkoff storyline, at least not yet. They're not rolling into politics over the top overtly, but they can't really escape it. I mean, look, Linda McMahon has a cabinet position. I mean, you can't really sort of escape it. But I think for them, they have to work under a different paradigm than Dana White and company, because, you know, they need to make that tent as broad as possible. And Netflix is a broad tent, right? I mean, that's the part of that deal is to bring in, or to potentially bring in, 200 million plus global people who subscribe to, and my numbers may be off, maybe it's a little under 200 million these days, but you know, who
300 million global.
300 million, there you go. Yeah. So I'm even on the wrong side. So yeah, so they have to approach it a little bit differently. But again, you know, all of these businesses, sports entertainment, sports adjacent, they're all going to be impacted by where the economy is, because I think at a certain point at a base level, you know, you're asking consumers to spend, and like consumers have that money to spend to be part of this stuff. So I'm sure, like, you know, I'm sure WWE in particular is hoping that, you know, there's some stability at some point. That said, you know, none of this, in my opinion, will affect like viewership on Netflix or anything like that. I saw what you guys have done. And I did see, I'll create the segue for you. I have seen the viewership drop a little bit, right, on Netflix in terms of number of viewers. I don't think WWE honestly would even be concerned at all in the near term about that potential stuff. The deal is in place. It's for 5 years minimum. It could go longer depending on if Netflix decides to go in or opt out. And so I think for their purposes, they're just trying to eventize the stuff. They're trying to make it feel like it's a big thing on both Monday and Friday. And I think if you're Netflix, you just want the presentation to feel big or to feel like something. And I think it has. I mean, no matter what you think of WWE, and there are certainly things about WWE that can be problematic, the look, the feel, the program itself, it feels big. It feels like a sporting event. Like it, when I watch that on Netflix, I feel like it's something unique and interesting on Netflix. The way, conversely, let's say if I watch Squid Game on Netflix, I feel like, oh man, like this is something like communal that I should be watching because like people are going to be talking about it. And I think at least at this point, the WWE has succeeded in that. It feels, when I watch that show, it feels more like an event than anything else, even if the storyline on a particular thing sucks. I hope I'm making sense there.
You are, because I think it's a consistent reaction that a lot have had over these, we'll say last like 2 years, is that if you've been a generational fan, I think you've just gotten into like the consistency of a Vince McMahon / Kevin Dunn product, and right. seeing it now through different eyes, that you're realizing like a shakeup was probably very long overdue, both from a creative standpoint, but also from an aesthetic standpoint, that I didn't think it would be received as significantly as it has, that just changing the production has definitely had an impact on the fan base to see this done with all of the muscle they can put behind a presentation of a show multiple times per week.
Yeah. And they were smart, because like what they, I think, instinctively knew is that a lot of the people who watch the product now grew up watching like some kind of sporting event or conventional sports, and sports sort of produced a certain way. And if you talk to sports producers like I have now for the last 15 plus years, you know, in many ways, they're trying to make the feel of a sporting event like a video game. You know, they want the viewer to almost feel like they are, could step inside the screen and sort of feel all that. So sometimes when you see in the NFL, you see almost that camera shot where it looks like a movie, like the running back might be like almost like he's walking into your home. That's kind of like, I think, what WWE has been going for in the last couple months on Netflix, is like they want you to feel like you're about to watch, like, you know, Texas versus Ohio State live in Columbus, and like the drone comes down from the top of the stadium and then spins around the crowd and stuff like that. And they have shots from like different angles that you've never really seen in WWE, coming out of Gorilla or something like that, or just framing it in a different way. So they've made it feel bigger. And then of course on the creative side, it's just up to the creatives to, like, if you're going to make the production feel bigger, then the storyline has to be bigger. And I think by and large, they've done that. And they've done that because they have a, you know, getting into the creative part, they just have so many really good performers at the moment. I would say if you're going to look at it on a sports context, I would say the WWE roster is the deepest it's ever been in terms of like high caliber talents. And if you look at it like in the same way, if you want to compare it to my world in sports, it's like you have the Golden State Warriors a couple of years ago. Like, that's your roster. You know what I mean? And if it's not Steph Curry who's keeping you there, well, then it's Klay Thompson. And if it's not Klay Thompson keeping you there, well, then it's Draymond Green or Steve Kerr. And that's where they're at right now. So they really, they're in a good position to do a lot of interesting things, given the Netflix deal. And, you know, we'll see, you know, in some ways too, they're in a honeymoon stage, right? People are still kind of excited it's on Netflix. That won't be the case a year from now. It'll just, that's sort of where the home will be. And I'll be real interested to see if they can still continue to maintain the kind of the viewership it does. And then lastly, and I know you guys will probably be talking about this for the next month, I do think WrestleMania is big, because it's the first time here on this. And the one thing Netflix has really indicated to the market when it comes to sports is they want events. They had the Paul Tyson fight, right? I mean, streaming was a joke, but it's still the idea that you can understand. They had the NFL, which was a big success for them. Both viewership-wise and production-wise, it felt big. It felt like an NFL thing. And then interestingly, as you're watching Netflix, they just bought the Women's World Cup for 2027 and 2031. That's an event, right? That's you don't have to broadcast the World Cup for 51 weeks. That's a 3-week tournament. Essentially, you know, they're not going to produce it themselves. I'm sure they'll outsource it to a Fox or an ESPN. But just think of, that's how Netflix thinks now, is they want their sports adjacent or sports stuff to be events. And so I think WrestleMania for them is huge, because that is an event. And I think if you're Netflix, you want to see, I think, really good viewership numbers on that. And you want to see that thing pop.
Still be on Peacock in the U.S., but everywhere else. Yes.
It will. And everywhere else. I'm talking globally. Correct. Mm-hmm. So that would be interesting. I know, you know, Brandon, I don't know if you'll be able to see it. John and I will. But I think your experience of watching that on Netflix would actually be pretty interesting compared to watching in the
maybe I'll fire up the VPN.
States. Yeah, can you VPN? Can you can you cross the border? We trust me. Canadians are nice, Brandon. We're going to let you in.
Don't charge me a reciprocal tariff.
No, I can't promise you anything at this point.
As more and more of these shows and sports too go to go to streaming. Something I thought about, and people are bubbling about it in the chat, we talked about last week, is that there's this report that AEW is being watched by an average of 500,000 viewers on Max, which would almost double what their total viewership would be between that and cable. And I mean, if that's anywhere near true, it sort of leaves as an open question about, like, well, how many people are actually watching this? And then how do you fairly negotiate for a deal when, I mean, in the case of Max, that's one thing. But in the case of Netflix, a lot of that's just first party data. Like, how do I go to different suitors and say, this is how many eyeballs I can give you if there's not a Nielsen, which there's in a general sense, there's not a yep. Nielsen third party providing data for this.
Great point. As a general rule, as someone who writes about viewership and sports, if it's not Nielsen measured, I sort of dismiss it. I'm not saying they're lying. I can't.
VideoAmp is measuring the third party for Raw.
I can't take proprietary data unless I have access to it without a healthy dose of skepticism. And that's not me saying someone is not telling the truth. I just think you have to approach it that way. Because I work in a world where CBS's March Madness, the WNBA, the NHL, they're all Nielsen evaluated. So at least I have a metric. Even if the Nielsen stuff has changed, and it's not apples to apples anymore, it's like apples to pomegranates because we have out-of-home viewing and we have a different way to look at it. It's still a baseline third party that's telling me this stuff. I have a lot of amusing texts back and forth with Amazon Sports as PR people. When I say it's like, is this a first party text or is this a third party text? It's my own like amusing inside joke. In terms of AEW, one, I think just as someone who obviously likes wrestling content, I think it's great that they exist. I really think it's important to have two major companies in the United States. So I hope they succeed long term. And obviously Tony's got a shitload of money, so that should be the case. But I would say, Brandon, to you in terms of like, you know, promising viewers, keep in mind WBD like needs programming. Like that's where AEW was in a good position. They lost the NBA, right? And if they still want to make the case to distributors that we have like a good portfolio, then you need as much stuff as you can, which is why you saw them, you know, they have the French Open. They got a couple of smaller level college football conferences. You know, they obviously have their March Madness connection still. They have a hockey deal, which probably wasn't the greatest deal like financially, but they still have it. And so WBD, if nothing else, provides them and Max with content and relatively speaking, like guaranteed inventory each week. So I think, you know, without obviously having talked to WBD's people about this, I don't think they're looking for like, you know, million people watching this every week. I mean, there probably is a bottom, a floor that they, you know, they really don't want. But I think by and large, if Tony and company can provide, you know, like a not horrible viewership number. Like I think for them, that's important for them to go to market and say, in addition to our traditional sports, you know, we have this, you know, WBD just had, they cut a deal with Unrivaled, which is the 3-on-3 women's network, women's basketball, organization that has a lot of great WNBA players that play in the, winter before the WNBA. That only averaged, 214,000, I think, viewers for the entire season. So AEW will beat that. So yeah. What I'm trying to say is my point is that like WBD doesn't, they're not playing in the world anymore where they have to have like a million and a million and a half, like for an episode of X. I think they're just looking for a baseline so that they can go to these, you know, Comcast and, you know, all these places and be like, you know, we're still going to charge you this amount of money because here's the programming that we have to offer. So for them, it's more, I feel like, AEW for WBD is an inventory proposition more than anything else.
It's got to do better than what would replace it. And the example yes. you point out, Unrivaled, it did a lot better than this new sport that they were trying out.
Yeah, and like scripted television is hard now. So like if you know your WBD, you know David Zaslav and company. I mean, like, what are you gonna throw like tons of millions of dollars? Maybe have a hit or maybe not. Like that's the. The one thing, and I know you guys know this, the one thing about sports, and I put wrestling into this too, is just that like there always will be a guaranteed audience for it. It might not be the NFL audience, but you can for something live that falls under the capital S sports, there will always be viewers who will watch that. And you know, there is a baseline number for that. You know, now you're hoping it's not 100,000, right? But there's a baseline number for that. And that's where I think, you know, that's why I think wrestling should always be okay, because unless something dramatically happens generationally where somehow like 10-year-olds just don't want to watch it anymore and they become adults and it's gone, there should always be an audience for it. You know, I guess the real big question is there enough of an audience to support two major companies or two and a half major companies on what is still considered traditional linear television? Maybe, you know, keep in mind, I don't know how much you guys like sort of have talked about this network, but you know, there's like networks like ION that pop up all the time that are like trying to get programming. They have deals now with the NWSL and the WNBA, and they've done pretty good with them. So there's always like,
nobody saw CW and NXT.
There's always networks that want inventory. So you'd be surprised how many places are looking for this. You may not get the Netflix deal, but generally speaking, you can find somebody. If your product is halfway decent as a production, somebody's going to put it on. TGL is another perfect example. It did pretty well for this golf league that they just created out of thin air, where these guys are just, they're taking golf shots into a screen, you know, like, but you know, they drew 400,000-500,000 like tops for their, for their best episode. So in short, Americans like sports, period. There's your answer.
Last one for me, Richard, is just next week. What are you kind of looking for just in terms of like from a coverage standpoint, where this is where it's just all hands on deck of WWE carpet bombing media appearances and such? And conversely, what is kind of the Athletic's sort of purview when it comes to a big like event like a WrestleMania? Will they look at coverage regarding the event in the week leading up to it, or the broadcast itself from your point of view?
No, excuse me, the opportunity to say I don't want to get legentled. You know, I love that expression, legentled. It's like my favorite thing. I'm sure I'll hear from Chris Legentle after I just dropped it on your – because I know WWE people listen to you guys all the time.
Hi, Chris. It's John and Brandon.
There you go. So
– return my emails.
Yeah. You guys – I will say, yeah, for mainstream places, WWE – and I've said this many times publicly. I think I said it with you guys. They go out of their way to try to cater to mainstream places because they're always trying to get into more popular culture spaces. Okay, so getting to the Athletic, you know, again, with the caveat, I'm not an editor. I don't make editorial decisions. You know, I'm just a writer. I'm rank and file on the line. We have in the past covered wrestling when it comes to obviously like Vince McMahon, the cases against Vince McMahon. We've certainly done WrestleMania, like profiles around WrestleMania or documentaries that are sort of big that speak to that. I'm not sure what we're going to do. Honestly, I haven't heard any word. It's always, you know, for a place like ours, it's always tricky because like it is sports entertainment and not sports. Mm-hmm. So it's never going to be something we cover on any kind of daily basis or regular basis. But, you know, you can always make the argument sometimes that like there's public interest in this.
As a sports business story, like from that angle.
Yeah, as a sports business story. So I think I have no plans to do this, but if I pitched to my editor, hey, I'd like to do a column on how the relationship between Netflix and WWE has been over these first couple of months. Let me take a look at the numbers and just give my own perspective on production. I think they would green light that for sure. I'm not so sure if I'm like, hey, I'd love to do a profile of Rhea Ripley. Like that's going to get green lit because even if it would do good on page views, it doesn't really fit the Athletic's purview. I think for a big place like ESPN is more logical for that kind of stuff. They, you know, they, you guys have been in the business long enough to see they've gone through very weird iterations of we're going to cover it seriously. Now we're just going to sort of do puff pieces. We're going to do that. Like, I don't really know where they're at now, but it's a place where they might do sort of more conventional profiling. And then in terms of what I'm looking at, I think for me, I'm really going to be interested in like more of an sort of a like anecdotal feel of the run up to WrestleMania and how people are reacting to it. And I think probably the best way to do that would be social media sentiment at the moment, just to see, you know, how is it trending on X and Blue Sky and Instagram and places like that. And then on the night itself or the two nights itself, I'll be watching on Netflix because I'll be really curious to see how the production is. If they do certain thing, you know what? You guys will find this funny. I have no doubt they'll integrate Netflix with WrestleMania. Okay. Yes. And one thing I'll be watching for is like how absurd and over the top it is. Like, can they find that line between like, yeah, we got to give Netflix love, but no, we're not having Ted Sarandos come on and like hand Cody Rhodes the belt. You know, at a certain point, like when The Rock is giving like 5-minute promos on how great Netflix is, it's like enough. Let's like back. We get it. Like, you love Netflix. You love their money. Let's not ruin the kayfabe for us. So that would be one thing that I'll be looking for is like, undoubtedly there's going to be product promotion everywhere because that's part of this deal. But I think for creative, it's a bit of a challenge because you don't want to be like over the top shilling where if you're like an old school fan, like all of us, you're like, guys, like, you know, like at a certain, like, you know, is Paul Heyman going to like have Netflix like on the back of a sport coat as he's walking into the ring? Like, you know, at a certain point, it can't be too over the top. So that's what I'll be paying attention to. But I think, again, given the venue of where WrestleMania is, I think they're going to get a shitload of publicity. I just think like this one is going to be crossing over to mainstream significantly, especially WrestleMania week. That would be my prediction.
One of my favorite stories was I've always enjoyed whether it be a Fred Godelli or right before a Super Bowl when you would have the producer on. And there was one year I thought this would be a really cool angle to pitch to get like a Kevin Dunn. WWE PR could not have got back to me quicker to basically LOL. There is not a chance in hell this is happening that you would get an interview with Kevin Dunn. And I appreciated how prompt they were to turn me down for.
Yeah. And I would say, this is the difference. I think I'd have a shot. I mean, I'm just going to be blunt with your audience, just simply because I'm from The Athletic. I'm not from the wrestling press. And they have, since I worked at Sports Illustrated, catered to places that I worked for significantly. And I'm not naive to this. If it's not because they love Richard Deitch. It's because of where I work. And I think they have consistently, you know, there's a reason Jimmy Trina, my old colleague at SI, gets Roman Reigns and gets Cody Rhodes and gets big names. They want that establishment brand to promote what they do. So I think I'd have a shot at that. Where, correct, I don't think you guys would, because I think they would be very fearful as a public relations department to have one of their people with you because they don't know what you guys are going to ask. And if you guys start getting into legal stuff, that puts their person in a tricky jackpot spot. So I would say – I'm not sure I would get it, but I would have a shot, and that would be interesting. Also, you know, the other thing too is, and again, having, I feel like the producers of the NFL, MLB, NBA, there's not a downside to letting me behind the curtain, right? But there is a little bit of a downside how far the WWE production people want to let the audience behind the curtain to answer some of those questions. And that's, so it would be an interesting interview, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
it's, oh, of course.
Fred Godelli, like, there's no downside for him telling me like the cool shit he's putting on the field. But there's a little bit of a downside if you're WWE's head of production telling me some of the tricks that they do to make the magic happen.
Well, if Nick Khan wants to prove Richard Deitch wrong, he is more than welcome to come on this show next week, and we can chat about
any Nick Khan should be going on Pollock and Thurston, not just once, but it should be like an every week thing.
Absolutely. Pollock and Thurston and Khan. I mean, what more could we want?
That would be unbelievable. That would, by the way, that probably would be sponsored by Prime at some point.
Probably. Yeah. Goodness. You can catch all of Richard's work over at The Athletic and the host of the Sports Media Podcast. Thank you so much for lending some time. Canada's import himself. No tariff attached to Richard Deitch, who is probably going to be locking himself here to Canadian borders for the time being. But thank you so much, Richard, for joining us. And it's great to catch up with you.
Yeah, I appreciate and respect your work. Followed all the time. Thank you, John and Brandon.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Richard. All right, everybody. That was Richard Deitch. Two guests deep there. I think we solved the economy. We solved all the world's problems just like that. Brandon is he's a busy man. He's got to get going. So we're going to wrap things up.
We have we solved all of AW's problems last week, and now we have solved we've gone on to bigger and better things this week.
Maybe that should be the name of the show, The Problem Solvers. So next week, tune in. We'll be back to our normal time slot of 1 p.m. Eastern time. We'll see if Nick Khan is going to join us. Open invite, as always, to stop by. But what is going on in WrestleNomics? You have your latest merchandise report out for the month of March, and as well, the state of the business and some market-to-market comparisons for both AEW and WWE that are up at patreon.com/WrestleNomics.
Yeah, this is a new month, so we put out these monthly reports at the beginning of each month comparing this is how the attendance was according to WrestleTix, this is how estimated tickets distributed was in the same market, same event type. Is it up or down? Most of the WWE stories are up. Most of the AEW stories are down. And we have the most matches count, who's having the most matches, who's wrestling for the most promotions, as well as the top YouTube videos. What else? I'm probably forgetting some stuff. We just had AEW Collision Quarter Hours go up today. That's at patreon.com/WrestleNomics.
You know, I'm not a big proponent of having wrestlers on this particular show, but we might have to make an exception one of these months to have Fuminori Abe on this right. program. The Iron Man of pro wrestling.
That's a woman, isn't it? I did Google that yesterday or whenever it was I put that up. I think that's a woman who Fukujin Death and Kaori Yonayama. Oh, you're talking Abe. About someone different.
Yeah, Abe is a man, but Fukujin.
You're right. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yes.
Fuminori Abe, who had 18 matches in March, but which is the fourth most.
Look at that. I'm only 30 years of age. He's got tens of thousands of
matches. The pro fans are already yelling at us. They're steaming mad now.
They weren't sitting through this entire show by this point. But we thank you always for making it to the end of the show. We're back next week. 1 p.m. Eastern time, so check it out. And I will be back tonight with Waiting right after Dynamite to chat about what happens tonight in, where are they tonight? They are somewhere. Baltimore. Baltimore is where Dynamite is tonight.
Maryland.
That's what's coming up. Road trip? No?
No.
Definitely not. All right. We'll chat with you next week. Thanks to everyone for joining us on Pollock and Thurston. Big thank you to Richard Deitch and Brandon Ross for joining us today.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money. Like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.